Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. From Dalia Fahmy, writing for MSN Money, workers who help process Obama's paycheck face termination. Employees at a government agency in Cleveland, which processes President Barack Obama's paycheck, risk losing their jobs because they have failed credit report checks, according to Troy Marshall, a union leader at the Cleveland Office of Defense, Finance, and Accounting Service, DFAS. He says tighter security clearance rules introduced by the Pentagon 5 years ago have cost 25 DFAS Cleveland workers their jobs and threaten another 42. The rules are unfair, he says, because these employees don't handle classified information and are struggling to dig out of debt due to the economic crisis. We've had people who have tried to get their credit consolidated, but in this economy, you can't get loans, says Marshall, who also works as a management assistant at DFAS and who claims he was suspended after 17 years because of $6,000 he owes on credit card and hospital bills. Marshall says he has diabetes and heart disease. His wife has leukemia. Cleveland is a very depressed area. It's not like you can get another job, he says. Tom LaRock, a DFAS spokesman, said he could not immediately comment on particular employees, but he confirmed that DFAS Cleveland processes Obama's paycheck and that the DFAS staff must have their credit checked as part of a wider background screening they must pass in order to stay employed. The Department of Defense, which oversees DFAS, has conducted background checks for decades, but it was only in 2005 that DFAS's entire staff fell into the sensitive clearance category and became subject to comprehensive background checks. All DFAS positions are considered sensitive because our employees have access to Privacy Act information such as names, social security numbers, and bank account numbers, says LaRock, explaining that DFAS's main task is to pay military personnel and contractors. Everyone at DFAS, including himself, submits to a background check that covers everything from U.S. allegiance to drug use. The credit check is just a portion of it. Marshall, however, argues that DFAS is making decisions based simply on credit score. He says workers who failed the credit portion began receiving termination letters in 2007, and since then, 25 have either been fired or forced into early retirement. Another 20 have been suspended, and the rest are waiting for their fate to be decided, he says. The White House would not comment. Representative Dennis Kucinich, Democrat from Ohio, slammed DFAS's reported actions and says he will call for congressional hearings to investigate. This thing is nonsense because you can't punish people for having bad credit, he told ABCNews.com. DFAS is being very tough on their humble employees, while at the same time the people on Wall Street who committed financial misdeeds are getting bonuses. Representative Marcia Fudge, Democrat from Ohio, says she has written to DFAS's Washington-based director, Teresa McKay, demanding answers. Clearly, we want to make sure that people who work in sensitive positions have clearances, But to say that someone is a risk to national security solely because of their credit is a stretch, she told ABCnews.com. Like Fudge, Marshall says he's not opposed to credit checks in principle, but says he believes the government should take an employee's performance and work history into account instead of relying just on a credit score. He points out that all his performance reviews were marked exceptional or highly satisfactory. Credit scores, which have dropped for many Americans since the start of the economic crisis 2 years ago, have been causing a lot of trouble recently. As credit markets have clamped up, consumers with poor credit, who would have once easily qualified for new loans, are finding it difficult to keep up with their bills. Many have been forced into foreclosure or bankruptcy, especially if they also lost income after falling ill or losing a job. In addition, homeowners are discovering to their dismay that enrolling in the government's loan modification program can cost them up to 100 points on their credit score. Despite these pressures and admissions by some employers that their workers have little control over their credit score during a recession, employee credit checks are becoming more popular. Private companies, for example, are increasingly looking into candidates' credit histories, trying to gain insights into their character. Karen Terry, a customer service representative at DFAS, who was suspended last summer, says she doesn't understand why the agency won't help her pay off her debt instead of threatening her with termination. "We want the same privileges they give enlisted military members. Let us set up an allotment and take it out of our paycheck to pay our debt," says Terry, a mother of four. She claims the Pentagon told her she was suspended after discovering a $6,500 debt and a history of missed tax payments. "We're trying to deal with everyday challenges to keep a roof over our head and put food on the table." So that was an article about the government agency, the DFAS, firing employees with poor credit. Now, jumping over to the job situation, despite the fact that the Labor Department announced that the American economy as a whole added 200,000 jobs, that's not necessarily completely good news. According to a report from payroll processor ADP, all those jobs are government jobs and mostly temporary ones from the Census Department. They say that the private sector actually lost 23,000 jobs in March. The latest ADP report showed large businesses with 500 employees or more shed 7,000 jobs, and medium-sized businesses lost 4,000 workers in March. Small businesses that employ fewer than 50 workers cut 12,000 jobs. Service sector jobs added 28,000, while factory jobs fell by 9,000 in March. The president signed into law a much-heralded jobs bill on March 18th that will give private sector employers a break on payroll taxes for the rest of 2010 if they hire people who are already unemployed. These data show that getting businesses to stop laying people off might still be as important as convincing them to hire. And just some food for thought, 1 million seconds is 118 days, 1 billion seconds is 32 years, and 1 trillion seconds is 32,000 years. Think of that in terms of the economy, both nationally and worldwide. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And now for the second segment of the show, we jump into what I have been going through, which is the two-income trap, why middle-class parents are going broke. It is a book by Elizabeth Warren and Amelia Warren Tiagi, her daughter. And the book provides breakthrough solutions to the biggest crisis families face today. I start with a credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tiagi, who are two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend their books, All You're Worth and The Two Income Trap, which really emphasize helping middle-class people. You should also visit the archives at www.kruufm.com. Look under Life and Debt so you can review all of the shows which I have produced to help you with issues regarding debt. Now, last week from the Two Income Trap, I was discussing how over the last generation, women have improved dramatically in their income. In fact, since 1960, women's wages have grown 10 times faster than men's. Women with children were not left behind. Today, employed women with children earn just 4% less than their childless sisters. Also, women face a much lower risk of unemployment than they did a generation ago. They are more likely to own their own businesses, and a growing number earn more than their husbands. Women haven't yet caught up with men, but they are gaining fast. So we see that women are making more money. The other issue I discussed was the child support issue, the deadbeat dad, and how Congress passed a series of laws from 1980 that guaranteed women all around the country the opportunity to garnish their ex-husband's paychecks. Congress also ordered uniform support guidelines in 1984, rather than putting women at the whims and prejudices influencing their case from various factors affecting the judge. The penalties for non-payment have been stiffened. In some states, a man who falls behind on his child support payments stands to lose his driver's license or his work permit, such as a contractor's license. In some places, he may even be thrown in jail. While the system is still far from perfect, the improvements have helped millions of women. Since 1976, the proportion of women receiving child support has increased 17% for divorced mothers and 300% for never married mothers. Great improvements. Now, this was generally the feminist prescription. Today's middle class mothers embark on single life with better educations, better job training, better legal support, and bigger paychecks than any women in history. They're backed up by more effective state-sponsored child support enforcement than ever before. In a single generation, their gains have been nothing short of extraordinary. So, Professor Warren asked the question, with all that progress, we should confidently predict that while single mothers may still have a tougher time than married parents, which is what we've been looking at in the last week, their situation must be improving. And the question is whether that's right. But her response is no, that's actually wrong. Despite all the progress, middle-class single mothers are no more financially secure today than they were a generation ago. Looking at her data, it shows that despite their amazing advancements at work, in school, and in the courts, these women are actually less secure than they were 25 to 35 years ago. Professor Warren is basing her book largely on data she gathered from bankruptcy filers. It all started when she saw that the single mothers in bankruptcy are more likely than any other group to file bankruptcy, more likely than the elderly, more likely than divorced men, and more likely than minorities, and more likely than people living in poor neighborhoods. This was a shock to her and Amelia. They discovered that single mothers are 50% more likely than married parents to go bankrupt, and 3 times more likely than childless people, married or single. Motherhood is now the single best indicator that an unmarried middle-class woman will end up bankrupt. In the world of financial devastation, there are 2 groups of people, single mothers and all the others. Now, besides bankruptcy, Federal Reserve data revealed that 1 in 11 single parents are more than 60 days past due on their bills, compared with 1 in 30 married couples without children at the turn of the century. Single mothers are also more likely to lose their homes. Professor Warren analyzed unpublished data from the Department of Housing and Urban Development and found that among single parents who had purchased a home in the 1980s with a mortgage backed by the Federal Housing Administration, more than 1 in 10 had lost their home by 2002 because of foreclosure. Now, certainly this is even worse today as the foreclosure crisis is exploding across the country. Professor Warren says that the difficulties facing single mothers are not the inevitable consequence of bringing up children without a father around. The bankruptcy courts weren't always flooded with single mothers. Quite the opposite. In the early 1980s, about 69,000 unmarried women filed for bankruptcy in a single year. Unfortunately, Professor Warren did not know how many of them had children, but using some suppositions, if we say 45% of these women had children, the same portion as today, the data would then suggest that in 1981, there were at most 31,000 single mothers at the end of their financial ropes. She points out that this assumption actually overstates the number of single mothers in bankruptcy in the early 1980s because there were relatively fewer women raising children on their own back then than there are today. So it's probably even worse than the supposition. In short, there would have been about 1 in every 200 single mothers filing for bankruptcy in a single year, implying that single mothers may have been somewhat more likely to go bankrupt than married couples or single men, but only somewhat. What this means is that, for the most part, single mothers a generation ago were swimming in more or less the same financial pool as everyone else, and they had about the same chances of staying afloat. But the professor points out that the economics shifted powerfully in those years since 1980. Today, more than 200,000 single mothers go bankrupt every year. That translates into 1 in every 38 single mothers filing for bankruptcy in a single year. At a time when women are advancing on multiple fronts, economic, political, educational, legal, the number of single mothers going broke has increased by more than 600%, and the gap between single mothers and everyone else continues to widen. If current trends persist, more than 1 of every 6 single mothers will go bankrupt by the end of the next decade. The professor looks at it from another angle. She says perhaps these women are the unlucky ones the women's revolution left behind. Could they be the teen mothers and welfare dependents that the media usually associates with poor single mothers? Well, the answer is no. The women represented are predominantly middle class, exactly the women who were supposed to have benefited from all those advances made by the women's movement. These women took advantage of improved educational opportunities. In fact, single mothers who have been to college are actually more likely to end up bankrupt than their less educated sisters, nearly 60% more likely. They are also more likely to have a good job. While a few of the single mothers who crowd the bankruptcy courts are doctors or lawyers, most of these women have decent jobs. They are scattered throughout the employment spectrum, but there are more teachers, managers, and administrative assistants in the bankruptcy courts, and fewer fast food workers and cleaning women than there are in the general population. Single mothers in bankruptcy are also more likely to have achieved that cornerstone of the American dream, home ownership. Fully 52% of these women owned their own homes, compared with just 36% of single parents in the general population. Nor are they especially young. Nearly 80% of these women have already passed their 30th birthday. The single mothers who file for bankruptcy are not some distant group imprisoned in a faraway ghetto. By every social measure we can assemble, these women are a solid part of the middle class. They are not strangers, they are our neighbors. They have flown higher than any earlier generation of women, only to discover that they fall farther. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So let's continue to analyze the single mother and her plight. So what is the continuing fallout from that two-income trap? In a typical story, a woman who's had positive influences in almost everything we just discussed until, for example, her husband moved out, there is sometimes a big black mark against the family balance sheet. Before the breakup, let's suppose the family had cashed out their savings, sinking it all into what the couple hoped would prove to be a wise investment, their first home. Not unusual. Even if they bought a relatively inexpensive home, the parents wanted their children to have a place to call their own, to have a yard, to know their neighbors, to grow up in a house, to have a rich experience. Of course, the couple puts together a simple financial plan. The husband's salary is to maintain the family, and the wife's was to pay the mortgage. So then comes the separation and divorce. Now the husband's paycheck was gone, and the wife is stuck. Her paycheck maintained the family, but there was nothing left to pay the mortgage. This is a very typical scenario. She gets months behind on the mortgage because she was just trying to keep the family fed, and it was hard. So the foreclosure notice arrives, she files for bankruptcy, and works out a repayment plan with the mortgage lender. And for a woman like this, she feels like this is the lowest point in her life. She goes ahead and files, but it was done very, very reluctantly. A person does it because she can't keep asking people like her family to continue to bail her out. But it could be that in some cases, the relief provided by the bankruptcy courts is only partial. The monthly payments for her home actually increase during the filing time because of these adjustable rate mortgages, increased property taxes, increased mortgage insurance and property insurance. And when the person, even though they're in bankruptcy, looks at the bottom line, they have additional sums to pay off in late fees and past due interest that the lender tacks on. And then there's some time frame within which the extra has to be paid off. If it's in a Chapter 13 bankruptcy, it would be at least 3 years if the person is below the median income, or whatever it is that the lender decides. And frankly, this usually is not a very comfortable situation for the person to be living in. Oftentimes, these people who are trying to deal with the monthly payments, when they add it all together with their property taxes, mortgage payments, utilities, etc., these bare necessities, for some people, it's a huge percentage of their take-home pay, much more than 50%. Often pushing 3/4 or more. Now, a woman like this is often thinking about giving up the home, but emotionally is reluctant to do so. When there's a divorce, kids have gone through a lot, and there's a lot of instability, and you want the kids to have stability. Mothers in these situations feel that they want to hold on to the house as long as they can. There's some stability, there's some security. It is their homestead. So stepping back and analyzing this, if we took the typical approach to economic difficulties facing single mothers, we would start the investigation on the day the husband walked out. And then you'd ask the usual set of queries. Did the divorce court treat the woman fairly? Did the judge order enough child support and alimony? Did the ex-husband follow through on his legal obligations? Typical inquiries. But as Professor Warren points out, the problem with this kind of approach is that it focuses attention really far too late in the story. Like so many single mothers, the financial problems start back when she was married, when she and her husband stumbled into the two-income trap by committing both of their paychecks to cover their monthly expenses. The family no longer had a stay-at-home mother who could take a job after her husband moved out. That is, there was no way to bring in new dollars to cover the costs of divorce. And those costs do add up. There are lawyers, one for him, one for her, court costs, document preparation fees, charges for photocopying the legal and financial records. And those costs are substantial if the parties can agree on everything. If they fight, the lawyers get richer, and the legal fees are only the beginning. Someone has to move out, and that means cash for first and last month's rents, generally, phone installation charges, separate checking accounts, some furniture, dishes, etc. Those are normal, those are typical. But then there are also unexpected costs, which tend to creep higher when there are no longer two adults to divide the chores and help each other with life's little emergencies. Will he send out his laundry and eat out more often? Probably. Will she hire someone to change the oil in the car and clean out the gutters? Usually. Without dad to share the burden, will she miss work more often when the kids get sick? Without a doubt. Will he give up overtime on Saturdays because that is his only day with the kids? Yep. With the savings account drained by the legal bills and the cost piling up, the credit card may be the only way to fill the gaps. And that's disaster, which will come in time. After divorce, the couple still has to meet their regular financial commitments, those that are the hardest kind to cut back. The biggest item in the family budget is the home, which would make it the most logical place to try to downsize. But mothers are guided by more than a steely eye on the balance sheet. They strongly resist pulling their children out of a familiar school and neighborhood at the same moment that their family life is disintegrating. Also, many women fear that without their husband's income, they will never get approved to buy another home, even one with a smaller price tag. They are haunted by the nameless dread that if they relinquish that precious bit of real estate, they will be letting go of the middle class aspirations they hold for their children. Where else can they cut? Should they sell mom's car, the one she drives to work every day? Should they pull Junior out of daycare or tell their son to quit college? Should they drop health insurance? So you see, this isn't a matter of living more frugally. These are the costs that families incur to keep their children safe and hold them securely in the middle class, even when there is no longer a father in the home. To give these up is to admit more than financial failure. It means failing as parents. So where does that leave the newly single mother? She is living the feminist dream, better educated, earning far more than her sisters of a generation ago. Yet, in the wake of the divorce, she will learn just how far she can fall. In the 1970s, the typical one-earner family had 46% of the husband's income left over once the housing, health insurance, and other fixed expenses had been paid. Now, if that couple split up, the wife's discretionary income, once she collected child support payments and found a new job, would fall to just 19% of the family's pre-divorce income. Now that's a staggering drop, making it tough for the newly formed fatherless household to survive a generation ago. But things are worse for today's working mothers. Today, the two-earner married family starts out just slightly better off than the divorced woman of a generation ago, with only 25% of income available for food, utilities, clothing, and all other discretionary purchases. But if today's two-parent family is squeezed, the post-divorce mother is crushed. The typical two-earner family in this decade would drop to a mere 4% of the family's pre-divorce income for the woman after a divorce, even after she collects child support. The middle-class life she and her husband once provided for their children would vanish. So the numbers tell a much more frightening story than all of the myth. And we will dive deeper into this next week. This is Bankruptcy Attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt manageable life.